Microphone check. 1, 2. CC. Hello and welcome. CC. Hello and welcome.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
She sells seashells by the seashore. She sells seashells by the seashore. There we go. Rolling.
I also love to attend festivals. I think that is where I've found some of the best contacts for myself for my making the next film. Particularly, I think we're filmmakers who are geographically not in New York or LA, which would include myself. These are kind of the only opportunities to network casually with a lot of filmmakers who have skill levels that are at or above your own. It's a fun time to be a filmmaker, particularly in documentary.
Hello and welcome to The Documentary Life, a show that sets out to inspire and inform you on how to best live and lead your own documentary life. I am your host, Chris G. Parkhurst, and this is episode number 81. And it is brought to you by Barong Films, proud creators of documentary film, the Documentary Life podcast, and the Documentary Academy, our industry-changing A to Z documentary filmmaking program that will transform you into the documentary filmmaker that you've always wanted to be. Find out more at thedocumentarylife.com/academy. Film festivals have long been the gateway for the doc filmmaker to get his or her film initially out into the world. The hope, of course, is that the film will get into a Sundance or a Toronto International or an IDFA and be seen by a distributor and then purchased for a bunch of cash in a 3-picture deal. At least that's what the hope used to be. Of course, those dreams, they've long been over, and we doc lifers have hopefully reshaped our thinking around the film festival and how it might best benefit us. Nowadays, we're looking to get our films into a handful of respectable festivals and take the momentum gained from this exposure to either distribute ourselves or get picked up by an online distributor like Netflix or Amazon, or get broadcast on HBO Docs or PBS in the States or BBC in the UK. A year ago, we ran a very special 2-parter on the film festival for the documentary filmmaker. The idea, it was to pull back the curtains of a documentary film festival, in this case the Melbourne Documentary Film Festival, and see how they operated and how the doc filmmaker could best leverage the power of a film festival to propel their films and careers forward. Lyndon Stone, the festival director of MDFF, and 2 filmmakers who had their docs shown at the festival, led us through the 2 special episodes. It wasn't all that surprising that the show went over pretty well. As I said before, we doc filmmakers, we've always known the power and potential of getting our films into festivals. This is part 2 of this year's special on hacking the film festival. If you haven't listened to the first part, or perhaps even last year's 2-parter, I'd highly recommend doing so. While you'd be fine jumping straight into this episode, you'd also miss out on appreciating it as a part of a much larger discussion on film festivals. When we come back from a quick break, we'll get right into part 2 of this year's 2-part special on the Documentary Film Festival by once again reconnecting with our good friend Lyndon Stone, the festival director of MDFF. And then we'll meet up with our 2nd doc filmmaker, Dawn Mickelson. Her film is Risking Light, and it has not only been accepted into numerous film festivals, but it's been winning awards along the way as well. It's all coming up next on The Documentary Life. Lyndon, is there anything new or unique for this year's festival? And I don't necessarily mean the filmmakers or even the films that are showing, but is there anything unique to your approach to this year's that might be different from last
Yes.
year's or the year before?
I guess documentary web series is a new one. We've got a few documentary web series, Street Barbers, and also got Squee the Fangirl documentary web series. So basically what we're doing is we're screening the first episode and then kind of getting people to go online to watch the rest of that. So it's good to be experiment with, you know, documentary web series. I see Netflix is getting into that as well. Yeah, it's good to be able to look at different ways that documentaries express and experiment, particularly in a startup stage, you know, different ways or different forms documentary can take shape, you know, and stuff like that. So that's very exciting, you know, to be able to do that.
And let's talk about Dawn Mikkelsen and her film Risking Light a little bit. And I have to say,
sure,
I do have a little bit of a soft spot in particular for this film. And it's in part because one of her subjects, Keelong Ung, I know actually quite well, having done a lot of work in Cambodia, of course, myself, and then living in for many, many years in Portland, Oregon, where Keelong is, where lives now and has for a long time. So I have a soft spot for that film because of the Cambodia and Keelong Ung connection. But it's a great film. Risking Light is a wonderful film. But tell us about Dawn and tell us about Risking Light.
It's an amazing documentary on compassion, and it's, I guess it is, you know, there's the Australian component about the stolen generation, Deborah Hocking, which, you know, obviously was a big factor in terms of selection.
Oh, yeah.
And stuff. But it is just, I won't say emotional, but it's an amazing story. It seems, you know, just as a spectator watching this documentary, seeing these people, you know, leverage compassion in a way to help them to get to, you know, a better place, you know, in their own lives.
Right.
And it's just a very moving kind of piece of documentary. You know, I think for a lot of people, it looks almost unusual because not many people are like, you know, Keelong Ung or Deborah Hocking, you know. Mm. So it's just kind of their own conception of compassion, and compassion, you know, it's not kind of letting the perpetrators off. It's more saying, you know, I want to be empowered to use this experience in a positive way than being kind of embittered or being brought down by the situation. And it puts them in control of the situation as well. So it's not about kind of letting the perpetrator off, you know. It's really about them. It's being very much using this kind of power in an unconventional way to get over some aspects in their own life. And I think, you know, a lot of people can learn a lot from that, you know, particularly in perhaps, you know, war-torn regions, you know, work can do a lot more compassion, you know. And but I think it's unusual for a lot of people like them. And I think that's kind of where a lot of interest will come from. Like, you know, how do these people do this? Like, I'm still trying to get my head around some of the stuff that they, you know, they can do and how strong they are. So incredibly strong people. And it's a fantastic documentary. Very proud to have it, the Australian or international premiere.
Yes.
Deborah is coming out as well, which is going to be great.
Wonderful.
And so it's a great acquisition, and really happy to have Dawn on board. And she, I think she's going to do a Skype Q&A as well, which would be great.
Oh, cool. And, you know, Dawn mentioned in my conversation with her that that you guys had been in contact with her. When she was in early on in production of the film. And so she had mentioned that herself as well.
Crowdfunding, yeah.
And obviously there's the Australian connection and that component to the film. But I guess, what was that contact like? And then what kind of contact did you continue to have with Dawn, or did she have with you up to and leading to, applying for the festival?
Well, same with like Disaster Capitalism and her documentary Risking Light. It was at the crowdfunding stage. We're just trying to help them out with promoting that and having a chat to them, and said it looks very interesting. And then kind of left it at that, and then they got in contact with us. So it was kind of like, oh, you know, so, you know, we originally kind of, you know, wanted to kind of promote their crowdfunding, or it looked interesting, so we contacted them. And then, you know, we just kind of, you know, and then they got in contact with us after, said it's ready, it's finished, and, you know, we'd love to come with you. So, oh, okay, great, you know. But it's also awkward because, you know, I've got a lot of friends that want to, you know, screen, and I run the screeners past some of my curators, and sometimes, you know, it's a democracy, you know, sometimes they don't get selected, you know?
Yeah, that's right. It's not all going through Lyndon. You have a number of people looking at this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it puts me in an awkward position because, you know, I've got I don't want people to take it personally, but it is a democracy. I do run it past curators, and it is very much a collaboration between James, who runs the curation team, and myself. So, you know, it is really a collaboration in terms of the official selection. It's just not me just picking them all. It's really, you know, just 40 curators led by James who have helped pick them out. I've worked with James and we've signed off on the official selection. So very much a collaboration. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And as we wrap up here, Lyndon, I'm curious if there are any final sort of thoughts or words you'd like to share with us, and whether it's from the festival's perspective or whether it's about MDFF in particular this year, or perhaps something that might help out doc filmmakers when they apply for their film festivals.
I guess, you know, a lot of people do kind of contact the film festivals, and I guess it's a good way to be able to sound it out whether it's the right fit or not to submit. So that can actually be a really helpful way to make sure that, you know, the film is a good fit for for both them and the festival. But I guess it's just kind of, you know, having this kind of support. You know, we support the filmmakers, support the film festival, support the industry. And I hope people see that, like they support the filmmakers, support the festival, to support the industry, so that we all kind of all help each other, all in this kind of industry together. And so I don't think it'd be an unfair thing to say, Chris, without this festival, a lot of films wouldn't have an Australian debut or even get screened in Australia. So it plays an important role, you know, and it's still a startup. There's some things that can be improved, obviously, but we're learning a lot from that, and our heart's really in the right place. And, you know, we all have day jobs. We kind of do this as kind of a passion project on the side. So, you know, we put in hundreds and hundreds of hours. You know, it's not just me. There's like, you know, a team of 40 curators have gone over all the screeners. People worked very, very hard, put in long hours. My assistant festival directors worked very, very hard. So it is very much teamwork, very much trying to help filmmakers out, you know, help Melbourne out by putting on a really nice event. So I hope people, you know, take to it in a positive way and constructive, and can see what we're trying to do than otherwise, you know. But really, it really is. I hope that comes across. You know, we are, you know, an empathetic festival that does try to help people out. And, you know, as I say, you know, moving forward into the future, reforming the competitive film festival, a lot of film festivals don't pay a screening fee. I think it's getting to a point now, moving forward in the future, that we look to actually put that in or get them to Australia, either or, you know. So I think that's probably the way to go. It's the right thing to do by the filmmaker.
We've been speaking with Lyndon Stone, the festival director of Melbourne Documentary Film Festival, or as MDFF as it's often referred to. This is the second year we've done this special series, and I'm excited, you know, not only as someone, as the host and producer of this program, to have you on here now 2 years in a row talking about your festival and talking about film festivals for the documentary filmmaker, but I'm also honored that you would share this information for all doc filmmakers, including myself. And so it's helpful for me as a doc filmmaker to be having this kind of conversation, this deeper conversation. And for one, I appreciate the conversation, Lyndon, but I also appreciate what it is that you're doing for doc filmmakers, specifically with your festival, Melbourne Documentary Film Festival. So really, on behalf of doc filmmakers, thank you for MDFF. And as last year, thank you so much for being on the program for this special series.
Oh, thanks for having me, Chris.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And thanks again for helping out with, you'll be a judge this year as well. You'll be helping us with judging, which is great. So have you enjoyed the screeners? Have you been enjoying the...
I've been loving it. I feel like I'm getting a bit of an insider's view. And, you know, I wasn't sure if we could mention that on the show or not. So, If we can, then I will formally thank you over the air for having me be a part of that.
That's fine.
It's been wonderful seeing the work that people are putting in, and I appreciate
it. It is
that.
And the Melbourne section is so good, isn't it? Like the it's so competitive. I really don't know who's gonna win, but
I think that's one of the tougher areas, to be honest. I really do. That's one of the toughest categories. Lyndon, thank you so much for carving out the time, and have a great festival.
I appreciate that, Chris. You take care.
Okay, hands up. Who here is living a documentary life? Would you say that you are? What does it mean to live a documentary life anyway? Well, we'll happily give you our definition. To us, living your documentary life means that you have crafted your lifestyle in a way such that you are able to make the documentary films you choose to make without it negatively impacting other aspects of your life, be that financial, your immediate relationships, or personal wellness. And furthermore, through the creation of your art, your existence is sustainable, creative, and fulfilling. Would you say this describes you? If not, is this something that you want for yourself? It was what we wanted for ourselves, and it took us quite a while to achieve it. Truthfully, there were many times we didn't think we'd make it at all. We were living in a world that was reactive rather than proactive, and it was costing us greatly. If any of this resonates with you, we'd like to help you find a better way. Because once we were able to honestly say we were living our documentary lives, we could look back and see what had gotten us there, and we knew we had to share it with others. We broke it all down and put it into Living Your Documentary Life, a program that helps you to craft your own lifestyle, relationships, and mindset in ways that empower you to make your best documentary films. You can find out more at thedocumentarylife.com/yourdoclife. I'm happy to welcome onto the Documentary Life today, filmmaker Don Mickelson. Don, you've got a bunch of background here in doc filmmaking. You obviously have been in plenty of film festivals, and we will get to all of that in a bit. But you know what? Welcome to the show today.
Well, thank you for having me. This is really fun to be able to talk to doc filmmakers about what we do.
It's a rare conversation, isn't it?
Exactly.
Don, your background initially consists of being a former television news reporter. Tell us a little bit about your TV news background and how that led you to doc filmmaking.
Well, it's interesting because I fell into television news because I was a hobbyist at making videos and never thought it was a career. And because I was like, nobody makes money doing that. Right. That's just something I do for fun. And when I graduated from college, there was an opening at the local ABC affiliate in Duluth. And I somehow talked the news director into the idea that I could be a reporter. I was a political science and women's studies major.
Awesome. That's
great. But he somehow agreed with me. I must have done a good sales job. And I was a news reporter with the ABC affiliate for about a year. It was absolutely documentary boot camp. It was how do you receive a story in the morning and at the end of the day go live with it with whatever you pulled together over that day and be okay with it, you know, know that you've done the best you can possibly do and still get it out in a timely manner. So it made me immediately less precious about my work. I've actually had in subsequent years had to learn how to become a little bit more more precious in the sense that, you know, now I'm doing feature documentaries and there's much more art to that. But I absolutely love that boot camp because it really helped me get over my fear of calling people and just, right, you know, calling and calling and calling and calling until somebody would say yes.
yeah, totally.
So it was a really good experience. And, you know, the impact of stories on audiences was very clear with that job. In the same breath, I also learned that I was not a television news reporter. Mm. It was a combination of things, including the format, the short format was, I got to feeling like it was almost by, you know, not lies by omission, but this sense that there are some stories that we need to tell and absolutely do not fit in that time frame. And those are the ones that I'm interested in telling because I want that nuance. I want to see the shades of gray. I want to feel more. And so after a year in news, I actually pulled out of my contract early.
Oh, wow.
Because I was just like, this is...
You felt that strongly about it.
Yeah, this is not for me. I love this work, but I can't continue doing it in this way. And so news director was really kind and let me out of my contract saying that, what was it? I couldn't get another job in news within like a 150-mile radius for another year. And I was like, going to be a problem.
I'm sure, yeah.
Because I was an on-air reporter.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
There was concerns there. But no, I am rarely on camera now.
And Don, at that point, did you really know that doc filmmaking was something that you were going to turn your attention to?
You know, I knew that it was something I wanted to do just as a hobbyist. And so I worked for a nonprofit in the Twin Cities in Minneapolis, an arts nonprofit as their communications person. And yeah, every weekend, and every weekend, my partner and I would go to northern Minnesota to film stories of LGBT people in northern Minnesota. This was right after Matthew Shepard.
Yeah.
And there was all this fear of what it is to be rural and queer.
Wow.
And so we were doing this mainly as a response to that. And again, as hobbyists, the goal was maybe it'll get on the PBS affiliate in Duluth. And
as long as
people in it are happy, then, you know, we've done a good job. And in the end, the film really had a life of its own and realized, hey, this is a thing. And this is more than just a hobby. And it turned into a career in a couple of years after that. And I, you know, had major ups and downs over the career, particularly financial. But it's always been when you really hit that down point, you go, am I doing the right thing? Should I be doing this? Mm. And in those moments, it was always, yes, no, this is what you're supposed to be doing. The questions rise and they quickly go away because this is just kind of what I feel I need to do.
You know, I'm curious, Dawn, is there a moment in time that comes to mind that was a real significant, a significant challenge for you where you thought, yeah, you know what, maybe this isn't the thing I should be doing, or maybe it is.
Yeah.
Can you share with us a moment or a story when that happened for you as a doc filmmaker?
Well, I will say that my first company was called Aquarius Media, and it was started by myself and my then life partner, Jamie Lee. And so we were filmmakers, filmmaker, business owner partners, and we were also a couple. And that relationship ended, and within a year, the company just wasn't going to make it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we tried to keep the company going, and it was a combination of the end of a relationship as well as the economy took a major downturn. I want to say this was 2006.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it was like it nosedived. You know, the value of the house went upside down. You know, all these things happened. And so I ended up in a financial situation where I was just like, what am I doing?
Ugh.
You know, is this worth it? I mean, I have all these skills. I could parlay them into advertising or, you know, all sorts of different places. What is this really that important to me? And then, you know, at the end of the day, when I'm renting out my house and living with my parents for a couple of years.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Of course.
And in the same breath, I was like, no, I want to make films. This is what I want to do. I'm going to have to figure out how to write this ship.
Yep.
And that, this is the thing that I find my identity in. This is the thing that I find value in. And this is what I'm going to do. And so that was a big turning point for me, was realizing how important it was.
Well, obviously things have worked out for the better.
Yes.
They've worked out for you. You have a number of films under your belt: The Red Tail, Green, Green Water, This Obedience, Treading Water, a documentary, and of course now the most recent film, Risking Light, which we'll get to here momentarily. This is, as you know, a program, part of a two-part series about film festivals. All of these that I have just mentioned have played at film festivals. I guess to begin this part of the discussion, I'd love to hear for you, what was it first like entering into film festivals? What was the game like for you when you were first doing that?
So that would have been Treading Water, and that was the late 90s, early aughts.
Yeah.
And at that point, I had no idea what festival strategy was.
Yeah.
So we were just throwing that film anywhere we thought
Yeah.
You were like, I heard about this one festival over here, let's try that one. And
totally.
You know, so we didn't understand the notion that you submit to the bigger festivals before you submit to the smaller festivals.
Right.
So all sorts of mistakes were made. But there was also this, I think, view that was really prevalent in the late 90s, that time frame, that, you know, there's still this I don't know, wide-eyed view of festivals as being the answer.
Of course, once
your film goes to a festival, you'll find a distributor, they'll take your film and pay you money.
They'll give you a three-picture deal. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's how you make your career.
Yes.
And that perspective has shifted dramatically. I mean, I submit now to more festivals than I submitted then, but I'm you know, hella more strategic.
Yeah, right.
And my expectations are much more about building audience, building a good buzz for the film, you know, possibly finding distributors. Mm. But if that happens, that's wonderful. But it's not a failure if I go to a festival and find that pot of gold, if you will.
Yes. Well, what would be good, Don, is if you could, maybe you can give us a snapshot of what your film festival strategy looks like nowadays. And why don't we use your current film, Risking Light, which is going to play at MDFF, the Melbourne Documentary Film Festival. Let's use Risking Light as your example. What was your film festival strategy with Risking Light?
Well, Risking Light, you know, we had the kind of traditional film strategy of let's try the big guys and then see where the film lives, find out, you know, where it has traction. And it's been interesting because the responses to the film by festivals have been either, you know, disinterested or really interested, like more interested than I've experienced before, where festival directors are like, we want you. And that's been the dramatic difference in opinion has been really fascinating. It's not that, you know, the other festivals were like, oh, this is a horrible film. They're just like, you know, traditional letter. We don't, you know, it doesn't fit in our festivals this year.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. Which is fine. But the passion of the directors that do like this film has been overwhelming and really affirming that, you know, there is a world for this film. And so we started, you know, trying to find our U.S. premiere and or world premiere. And our U.S. premiere was first. We ended up at the Cinequest Film Festival in San Jose as our world premiere.
Okay.
And then went over to Cleveland and then Minneapolis. And then we've got a handful of other festivals going on beyond that. I think this weekend I'm going to the Duluth Superior Film Festival. But then once we landed with...
That's a great name, by the way, Duluth Superior.
Yes. Because it is superior.
Totally.
And it's on the lake. but really excited about Melbourne Documentary Film Festival, especially because one of our stories is from Australia.
That's right.
And Deborah Hawking, who's our storyteller from Australia, is going to be there at the festival on our behalf, actually. So she's going to be representing the film. It's the first time she's seen the film on a large screen. She's seen a draft of it on Vimeo. And we're going to try to Skype me in for a Q&A.
Fantastic.
So that I can be there. And I'm so excited that she gets to be there. The other three stories have all been to festivals. Ki Long was in Cinequest, and Mary and O'Shea were in Minneapolis.
Okay.
So this is, I'm just so excited about Melbourne.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And that's part of the you know, the rewards really of all the hard work that we do as doc filmmakers is really going to some of these film festivals. And in particular, if you can bring your subjects along with you, what a fascinating experience that in itself can be.
Absolutely. It was crazy actually for Cinequest because Ki Long's older sister, she's something of a lovely character in the film that we don't get to know too deeply, but I don't know if you were able to watch the film, but she was the woman who was smacking him on the butt, you know,
right.
And kind of that teasing sister, and she was chastising him for not teaching his children Khmer, and wonderful, wonderful woman who connected really well with our field producer Miranda Wilson, and she actually passed away a couple weeks before Cinequest.
Yeah.
And Ki Long was able to go to her funeral and then go to Cinequest and see her vibrant and beautiful. And so it was really meaningful for him to see her that way.
I was born in Cambodia.
This is where my house used to be before the Khmer Rouge.
I never believed what I was told, that you are no good, you will amount to nothing. Got news for you.
One of the hardest things I've had to do as a mum is to tell my children of my history.
Loramian was a smart kid. Hung out with his grandfather a lot until those teenage years. Loramian was at an after-hour party. There was gunshots, and Loramian was laying on the floor, and he yelled, "Don't do it," and the trigger was pulled.
You his mom, you should have raised him better. This is my thinking.
He was an animal, and he deserved to be caged for the rest of his life.
In full disclosure, interestingly enough, when I did watch Risking Light, Dawn's film, and to see that one of the characters was Keelong Ung, and I've known Keelong since 2004, he happens to be in the first documentary that I worked on, which was a film that we shot in Cambodia. Of course, I've mentioned it a number of times in the program. And that was pretty wild, Dawn, to see mm-hmm. Keelong on the screen. But, you know, not entirely surprising, because Keelong, he has had a voice for a while in terms of telling the story and really the plight of the Khmer people and what happened in the 70s and 80s. And he's a very well and an outspoken gentleman. And and I love Keelong. And that leads me to a question. You know, you have these three or four subjects. Is it three or four?
I consider them four, but they're three locations.
Three locations, right. It is kind of four subjects. That's right. Yeah. How is it that you, how did you find these subjects? Because as we know, they're in locations from all around the globe. So how did you find the subjects for Risking Light?
Well, the first ones were the easiest, and they were kind of the inspiration for the film. And that was Mary and O'Shea, because they're in Minneapolis.
Right.
They were, I was working on another short film project, actually, when I was introduced to them. And they were part of something called the Smooch Project, where they're kissing one another on the cheek. And then the side story was, oh, and by the way, he killed her son. And I was like, what?
Right.
So I was deeply moved by their story and decided that there was something there for a feature that I wanted to move forward with.
Yeah.
In the same breath, I felt like I was very aware and wanted to really talk about forgiveness as a universal theme that goes beyond religion and cultural beliefs, that this is something that pops up everywhere and is important. So within, you know, days of deciding to do this, I immediately put a call out to Facebook and was like, does anybody know anyone outside of the United States
who has
a good forgiveness story? And a friend of mine, an acquaintance on Facebook, said, I'm in a PTSD support group online with this man named Keelong Ung.
Mm.
And so he and I Skyped, and I was like, yeah, that's a good
one. Yeah, of course.
He's amazing. So that was how we found Keelong. And then my partner, who works in IT, he and I ended up moving to Australia for 2 months for his work. And I was like, live in Australia for 2 months? Uh-huh. Yes, please.
Yes, please.
I'm going to come along. And we had a 9-month-old baby at the time. So we brought her.
Yeah, I can relate. Love it.
Yes. And so we lived in Sydney, and I spent those 2 months networking, trying to find people to tell their forgiveness stories. And then what was particularly drawn to the public apology of the Stolen Generations and what that meant. And so, you know, it was like, basically inquiring, is there forgiveness there? Does anybody have a story? And that is where we found Deborah on one of the last weeks of that trip.
Yeah, she's amazing.
She is a wonderful woman. Yeah. Yeah, it's been, I guess, word of mouth and networking. And I feel like that's kind of how they usually go for me.
Now, I'm guessing that in terms of, and to get back to the topic of film festivals, I'm guessing that because, you know, one of your chief subjects took place in Australia, MDFF was a natural fit, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And how much research, and we can use MDFF or any festival you'd like for an example, but
sure.
But I'm curious, as a doc filmmaker, how much research are you doing into the specific festival, and what are the things that we need to know when we submit to these festivals?
It's been interesting because I have had a relatively good understanding of the U.S. festival system and a moderate understanding of the European system. Most of my films have done well in the U.S. and done well in Canada. I haven't done a lot of submitting internationally beyond. And in retrospect, feeling like, you know, that was a mistake, because there's some wonderful festivals outside of our borders. And, you know, so with this film, really wanted to, of course, have a screening in Australia, and still searching for that screening in Cambodia.
There's, you know, three festivals that come to mind now, and only one of those even existed, you know, more than 2 or 3 years ago. So
yeah, sure. And so that's definitely the piece of it, is like not being culturally aware of the film system in each country and what that's about. So I ended up leaning quite a bit on my cinematographer, Russell Hawkins from Tasmania. And he, you know, asked around his network, you know, where would you submit? Where would you submit? And I also connected with a filmmaker named Holly Pfeiffer, who she and I had been connected for a few years in relation to this film, but never directly collaborating. And so I was reaching out to them saying, what are the festivals in Australia that you would start at? And then going from there. So that was, it was partially how we landed at Melbourne Documentary Film Festival. The other piece is the festival contacted me 2 years ago, just before we were doing our final crowdfunding campaign. And they said, we heard about the film, we're interested. And I was like, we're not done.
Wow, that so, must be a pleasant experience.
It was nice.
A couple years before the film's released, they're reaching out to you.
Yeah, so 2 years later, I was like, hey, remember that thing? Are you still interested in the thing? And they're like, So that was really nice. And again, it felt like there are festivals who, you know, are like, we've got a lot of things going on. And then there are festivals who just want you. And those are going to be better experiences anyway, even if you get in a festival where there's a lot, you know, they think you're fine.
That's right.
It's better to be at the ones that love you.
Dawn, in general, why do you think the film festival circuit thing is so important for a doc filmmaker?
I think for me, it's important because it vets your film. It tells audiences, any kind of community partners and organizations that, you know, for your distribution strategy, that there is an audience for your film, and, you know, they're enthusiastic. So in some ways, the festivals are about proving that this is a film worth paying attention to. There's just so much media being created right now that people don't know how to process what is good, what is not, how do I, you know, so the festival system creates that vetting system to some extent. You know, I also love to attend festivals. I think that is where I've found some of the best contacts for myself for making the next film, which feels weird. You know, you're there representing one film and having conversations about another one. But
that's a great point.
Yeah, it's really, particularly, I think, for filmmakers who are geographically not in New York or L.A., which would include myself. These are kind of the only opportunities to network casually with a lot of filmmakers who have skill levels that are at or above your own.
And what are some of the things that maybe we should look out for as doc filmmakers when we're submitting to these festivals? And I think you can speak directly to this now, having five films, you know, to your name and I believe submitted to with all of them. What should we be looking out for when we're entering and we're submitting our films?
You know, the goal obviously is to get into the most prestigious festivals possible. So submitting to those first, primarily because a lot of the other festivals pull their programs from the big festivals.
Right.
So you theoretically will spend less time spinning your wheels once you you land the larger festivals. So that's nice. I mean, I found that with most of my films, that once we had our premiere at whatever the biggest festival we could for that film, and that is varied, that it becomes easier. You receive invitations, then the film begins kind of doing its own thing, and you get to kind of go along for the ride instead of driving. Well, you're still driving, but, you know, it's a different dynamic. You know, I also think it's really just so important to know what's important to you about a filmmaker. Like, where do you want this film to end up? Mm. Is it important that you reach a targeted audience, which with every one of my films, that has been the case, that they're, you know, I've always believed that the films have a universal or general public appeal, but then also acknowledge that there's going to be an audience that really resonates with the film well beyond the general public, that this is their wheelhouse, this is what makes them happy. And so, for example, with Risking Light, we're starting to reach out to film festivals that are much more involved in restorative justice and peace and peacemaking that kind of thing, because we know that, you know, even just the audience that shows up at the more mainstream festivals, the people that are over the moon about it generally start talking about their own theories on this. And I'm like, you have thought about this much more than most people.
It's great for dialogue and spreading the word. It's awesome.
Yeah. So finding that niche market within the festival circuit is, I think, really critical, because that's going to lead to so many more screenings outside of festival screenings that pay an honorarium or pay screening fees. And those are good things when most of us have bootstrapped these films and are likely somewhere in the red on them.
Yes, indeed, indeed. At what point in the process of Risking Light, of making Risking Light, at what point did you really start to begin thinking about film festivals?
I've been thinking about them from the beginning, but that's because this is my fifth feature.
Right. Well, no, that's important. That's what I want to hear, because it's obviously different from the first and even second one.
Yes. I've been thinking about them from the beginning and have been reaching out to a few of them that I have relationships with, you know, midway through, like, hey, this is on the horizon.
Fantastic. Just thought
I'd let you know. So many of them weren't just receiving it and like, what? What's this? Who is it?
Yeah.
Don made a new film. I also did crowdfunding campaigns that were pretty public for this. And so that also created a buzz for it that some festivals were aware of. But yeah, I've been thinking about them from the beginning, and that view has shifted throughout production as the story has evolved. And I'm like, initially I was looking at this film as, this is a story about forgiveness and reconciliation.
Yeah.
And then realized that my view of what those words meant was evolving, and that reconciliation was something that happens with Marion Doshea and is a beautiful thing, but is not required. And what I'm more interested in is forgiveness and what the impact of that on the victim, not the perpetrator.
As we wrap up our conversation, and by the way, Dawn, I feel like you're a kindred spirit and someone I could talk to about doc films for a long time, and perhaps we will have further conversations.
That would be fun.
Yeah, that would be. Are there any sort of thoughts that you might have that might be good for our doc filmmaking audience to understand about film festivals that maybe you truly didn't know early on and you wished you'd known? I mean, I know we could talk for another couple hours on that.
But I know. I'm like, oh man, this is going to sound really weird that I didn't realize this. I think I entered the festival world with a little bit of naivete. Yep, so when would first go to festivals with my early films, I would be very present at the screening and go to other screenings and really be engaged in the screenings. And I would usually skip the parties because I was like, well, that's just a bunch of people schmoozing and I don't want to be a part of that.
That's totally how I would have seen it. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. And I was like, oh, that's just so stressful. And why you put yourself through that? That makes no sense. And now I'm like, I make it to my screenings. I am lucky to see another film if I go to festivals at this point, and it's all about prioritizing those gatherings with other filmmakers. And that has been a shift, you know, because I guess believed in this notion that somebody will come up to you after your screening and be like, I want your film in the theater.
That's
not where it happens. It happens when you're sitting there having a cocktail with somebody and they're like, oh, you're the one who made that film. Yeah. Okay, let's talk. And so I can't say enough about the social
element
of festivals. And even if it's just, again, getting to know somebody who you might collaborate with in the future, that's, it's just critical.
And that's something that that is definitely a part of a conversation that we often have in the program, is this idea that as doc filmmakers, we can tend to be some of the more solitary people, given the work that we do. And we're often really the ones that are in most need of, you know, so I work both commercially and documentary, and the commercial world is infinitely connected, if for no other reason than out of necessity. We need to know who the people are. We need to know who the production managers are. We need to know who the producers are. We need to do this in order to continue to get hired. And doc filmmakers, we need it more than anybody, and we tend to be some of the ones that are the most, you know, we're lacking in resources, we're lacking in finances, and we're lacking in connectivity. And, you know, a big part of this program is trying to bring doc filmmakers together. And so we feel a little bit more connected and we feel less solitary. Yeah. And so what you're saying really rings true to a lot of the conversation that we have on the program. And that's, when you have films that are in film festivals, if you can make the attempt to go to the festival and dialogue and network afterwards, because you don't know where that can lead. And in fact, if nothing else, it'll at least make you feel connected to a community.
Absolutely. And I think that also the status of documentary has shifted so much in the last 20 years. And so the early festivals I remember going to, we'd go to social events and it would be 80% narrative, you know, fiction filmmakers and 20% doc filmmakers. And generally the narrative people were the ones who were like, hi, hello. They're trying to find their next gig, right? And they figured out the networking thing. And the doc filmmakers, I was like, and we are the nerds of the film world.
Yeah, right.
so, you know, it's like middle school and elementary school and high school all wrapped into one. And totally. I'm like, I'm the nerd here. But over the last 20 years, I think nerdiness has become cool, which is handy.
Which helps out.
So people are now like, oh, you make documentaries, instead of like, oh, you can't help me. Next person. So it's you get to meet all the other film, you know, documentary filmmakers, but then you also end up having great conversations with narrative people, which has not happened historically for me until the last, I would say, 10 years. I think that also points to the change in the medium of documentary and how it's becoming much more story driven and much more, you know, like a narrative.
Right.
Like a narrative feature in terms of how we do the storytelling, and those lines are blurring. And so it's a fun time to be a filmmaker, particularly in documentary.
I've been speaking with documentary filmmaker Don Mickelson. Don's film Risking Light is currently playing at MDFF. You know, when we release this episode, MDFF will be happening, and hopefully Don, Deborah will be in attendance, and I would love to hear how that goes. So by all means, I'll be reaching out, and I'd love to have you share with us how that experience is for Deborah.
Absolutely. I'm so excited that she's going to be there.
Don, thank you so much for being on the program. It's been a great conversation, and thank you for sharing your words of wisdom about the craziness of film festivals for doc filmmakers.
Oh, thank you. It's been fun.
Don't forget, if you're looking to live and lead a documentary life, you need to head over to thedocumentarylife.com/yourdoclife and take a look at our Living Your Documentary Life program. We'll help you craft your lifestyle so that you are able to make the documentary films that you want to make and live the doc life you want to live.